Okay, well, comrades, I'm not intending to give a completely comprehensive lead-off on this subject. I don't think we need to do that every time. And also, don't forget that next week we'll be discussing the United Front. So although I'll mention the United Front, you don't have to cover all of that. What I'm going to try and do is just tell the story. And I'm just going to tell one story, and that is about the rise of German Nazism. I'm not going to deal with Italy at all. So I'm dealing with fascism, and fascism obviously is our enemy. We take the case of the Nazis. When they got in, they destroyed the most powerful labour movement in the world in 3 months. They made the Communist Party illegal, they made the Social Democratic Party illegal, all independent trade unions ceased to exist, and this all happened within 3 months. Within a very short period of time, they were rounding up all the political opposition and putting them in concentration camps. And we've seen black reaction since the Second World War, but it was nothing quite as startling as this. And one of the reasons is that fascism is not just a bunch of soldiery charging through the streets trying to pick up what they see as dissidents. It is actually a mass movement. If there's a block of flats, there's always going to be someone who's a Nazi sympathiser saying, she's a troublemaker, he's a communist, and pointing them out. And that was one reason why the repression of the Nazis was so effective. Now, as we know, and as I'm not going to deal with, the German Revolution of 1918 to 23 was defeated as a proletarian revolution. There was a possibility of a workers' revolution between 1918 and 1923. The revolution broke out towards the end of the war, and the labour movement as a result of that revolution was split. It was split into the Social Democrats, who supported the existence of capitalism, and the Communists, who to start off with were genuinely revolutionary party. The Social Democrats, in order to support capitalism, and this is what you have to do in a time of revolution, actually organised various groups called the Freikorps, which were proto-fascist gangs, which used a swastika as their insignia, and in order to murder Liebknecht and Luxemburg in early 1919. So you can't get a fairly more dramatic and decisive split than that, when one lot of the workers' parties is murdering the leadership of the other lot of the workers' parties. Now, we would expect, when you're looking at the situation before 29, if you were revolutionary-minded, you would have written off the social democracy sometime after 1918 as a force for social change. So really, we're looking at the Communist Party and the policy of the Communist Party. It's still the smaller party in the workers' movement, but that's the party that has the ability to win over must win over the rank and file of the social democracy if there's to be a successful revolution. You saw this wave of revolutions between 1918 and 1923, but after their final defeat of the working class in November 1923, there was a revival of German capitalism. And German capitalism was quite a dynamic capitalism compared with British capitalism and French capitalism. And it responded very quickly. All the unemployment was gobbled up. Living standards rose quite fast. And all seemed to be well in the world until the Wall Street crash of 1929. Now, this had an effect, this prosperity, period of prosperity, had an effect on the Nazis. The Nazis were a large fascist party by our standards, a lot more important than the British National Party, for instance, but for instance in 1928 they had 180,000 members. The hard core of all these organisations was disaffected military. I mean, it'd be nice to say this is an entirely Germanic phenomenon, but this is what Mussolini used, and of course the black and tans who were used against the Irish were exactly the same sort of people. So there were a lot of brutalised people knocking around from after the First World War, and these were the hard cores of almost any street gangs that were involved. But the Nazis, who had significant support in this period of revolution and counter-revolution, seem to be drifting away. Now, the thing to be, there's a number of myths that need knocking on the head. One is that they were some sort of radical force because they called themselves as National Socialism. They're actually part of the right-wing bloc. Throughout this period, they voted with the right wing in the German Reichstag, in the German Parliament. They were not. They did not have an implantation in the working class. For instance, they had this ludicrous beer hall putsch in 1923 as part of this process of revolution and counter-revolution. 16 Nazis were killed. Hitler spent a few years in prison writing Mein Kampf, and he dedicated his book to these 16 people. And when you look at them, I think there's about three bank clerks. There's a hatter. There's some sort of civil engineer. There are no working class people. These are classic petty bourgeois, the hardcore of the Nazi party. It was a petty bourgeois party, and it was affected with the right wings. I mean, this perhaps happened later, but what happened in 1930 was that some of the German Nazis in Parliament moved a potential law calling for the nationalisation of the banks, which was part of the Nazis' programme. And Hitler got furious with these people and told them that they have to withdraw this resolution, which was Nazi party policy. The following day, the Communist Party came into the Reichstag and moved the identical resolution. So exactly the same words, nationalise the banks. And Hitler forced his delegates to vote against this resolution, which was their policy in which they supported the previous day. So they're a right-wing party, and they didn't have an implementation in the working class at any time till they took power. Now, what's the situation with the Communist Party? From perhaps 1924, the Communist International is no longer an organisation whose principal function is to carry through the world revolution. From that time, Stalin declares that we can build socialism in one country, and he turns the Communist International into a sort of international agency of Russian diplomacy. That's the situation. What's now in the later stage, we can definitely talk about betrayals. I mean, for instance, I believe the leader of the Italian Communist Party, Ercole, went over personally and assisted the torturing of Andrews Nin and those people in the Spanish Revolution. They're absolutely clear that they did not want the Spanish Revolution, that they saw the Spanish Revolution as a threat. We can't talk about at this stage about conscious betrayals between 23 and 33. Stalin did not want Adolf Hitler as his next door neighbour. You know, it was a defeat for the Communist International that Nazis took power, obviously. But having said that, the policies they pursued made victory of Hitler almost inevitable, because the reason for the rise of Hitler was the divided working class. Trotsky's position at this time was that his people should regard themselves as part of the Communist parties and should as the left wing of the Communist International. That what was required in the Soviet Union was reform. It was quite obvious that this was not a healthy worker state, but the idea was, if you've got a revolution, say in Germany, then okay, these deformities which did exist in Russia would disappear. You didn't yet need a political revolution in Russia. That was a conclusion that Trotsky drew after 1933. Now, let's follow through what the Communist International's policies were. After 1924, Stalin says, you can get socialism in one country. And he's in a bloc in Russia with the right wing, whose leader was Bukharin. And the mentality of the Communist International was influenced by this right-centre bloc. Instead of looking for the revolutionary possibilities, they looked at some sort of sympathetic force that they could cuddle up to. This was the case in the general strike in Britain, where they looked for left-wing trade union leaders to support. This was the case in China, where they actually told their members to enter into and to become organisers for the Kuomintang. So that was the policy of the second period. This coincided with a policy inside Russia of snuggling up to the small peasants. So the sort of mentality was exactly the same. For the gratitude they got from the peasantry in 1928 was the beginnings of a grain strike and a panic-stricken move by the bureaucracy to collectivise. A mad ultra-left policy in the Soviet Union consisted of one-sixth of the Earth's surface, and I understand a quarter of the Soviet Union was collectivised in 6 weeks by a couple of tens of thousands of chain-smoking, leather-jacketed commissars. All right, so that's quite dramatic. But coinciding with this mad ultra-leftism, which actually led to famine and millions of people dying of starvation, was the declaration of what was called the Third Period. So you'd have the First Period after the First World War, then you'd have a Second Period of apparently mild consolidation of capitalism, and then you had this Third Period, which was declared to be the final period of capitalism. And they came forward with the idea that the main enemy was not the real fascists, but what they called the social fascists. Social democrats and fascists are not opposites, but twins. This was the line that was being put in the Communist International, and it was a line that was faithfully carried out by the idiots in the German Communist Party. Now, Trotsky's position was as follows. He said that the struggle between the social democrats and the fascists is a bit like this conflict we had in Russia in 1917 between Kerensky and Kornilov. Kerensky was a reformist leader. He's a bit like the German social democrats. He's not the same, but he's more or less the same. He was an untrustworthy character. He didn't like the Bolsheviks. And when Kornilov, who was an outright right-wing general, monarchist general, started moving his troops towards the capital, he was only able to do so because Kerensky was signing the bits of paper. So Kerensky thought he was going to use Kornilov, but of course Kornilov was really using Kerensky to pull his troops towards the capital, where he'd go in, wring the necks of the Soviets, wring the necks of the Bolsheviks. Probably the Mensheviks would have gone out as well if he'd have had his way. Now, what was the position that the Bolsheviks adopted towards this? They didn't say, there's two possible positions that you can adopt. One is that Kerensky's a lovely bloke, we can have no political differences with him, we'll make a bloc with him, we'll water down our programme so that we don't have any differences with him, because the main thing is the struggle for democracy and against fascism. That was the policy of the Popular Front, which the Communist International carried out with after 1934. But their policy now was, they're all the bloody same. There's social fascists, there's Hitler fascists, and there's all sorts of different sorts of fascists. We don't cooperate with all of them. Now, this sounds very radical, but actually it was a completely stupid policy. Because what the Bolsheviks did in August 1917 was say, look, what we're going to do is we're going to support Kerensky, or rather we're going to support the Soviet institutions on which Kerensky reigns. We'll call on any decent reformist to join us, weapons in hand, in the battle against Kornilov. When we've settled with Kornilov, we'll come back for Kerensky later on. But at the moment, we're going to use, I think Trotsky used the analogy, we'll use Kerensky as a gun rest in shooting against Kornilov. And that was that policy is the policy of the United Front, which, you're going to do more fully next week. But basically the point is, if you've got something in common with reformist workers, you emphasise that. No question of ditching your programme. No question of saying, we don't remember that you killed Leibniz and Luxembourg. We still remember that. But if you're a genuine reformist and you want independent labour institutions to exist, and if you don't, you're not a genuine worker anyway, then we're prepared to join with you on this one issue, on this action programme. That was the policy. Now, let's go on with the story. The deadlock in the class struggle after the collapse of the New York Stock Exchange meant that the economy really started to go down as well. and the ruling class were looking for a way out, and there were revolutionary possibilities on the table. You got the situation where unemployment quickly went up to 6 or 7 million because the German economy was helplessly dependent on the world trade. Once world trade started to sink, the German economy was sunk. And what happened was they had a deadlock in the parliament, in the Reichstag. No bloc had overall control. You had this right-wing bloc, which the Nazis were part. Then you had the Social Democrats, and then you had the communists. And in 1930, the election produced a bombshell, because Hitler's party went from 800,000 votes to nearly 6.5 million. Nazism was back, became the second largest party in the Reichstag. The KPD went up from 3.5 to 4.5 million, and the SPD lost 1 million. And this is what you find all the way through. You find that the SPD and the KPD swap votes. You don't find members of the SPD and the KPD defecting from Labour movement parties and voting to the Nazis in any numbers whatsoever, right through to 1933. That does not happen. And the working class parties were completely separate, were almost, the working class movement was almost immune to the fascist virus. This was the situation in 1930s anyway. We saw the capitalists starting to think, well, how are we going to get out of this? 7 million unemployed. Germany needs to expand. Britain's not got as many unemployed. It's 3 million unemployed, which is pretty bad. Reason, colonies. We were stripped of our colonies in 1918. What we need is colonies. What we need is an expansionary war. And you got people like Krupp and Tyson. You probably read Rob Sewell's book, you know, that Tyson wrote this book, I Paid Hitler, where he actually regretted it and fled to the USA and wrote this book in 1937. The comrades who've read the stuff about Italy know, that Krupp stuck with Hitler right the way through, was one of the main props of the Hitler regime, and actually used slave labour in his steelworks right through towards the end of the Second World War. So significant sections of the capitalist class were actually now supporting Hitler. He wasn't just a fringe bunch of people who attacked pickets and murdered individual workers and that. They now had big business backing. You got a lot of elections in 1932. I don't want to dazzle you with electoral votes, but there was votes for the president. Before that, there was something called a red referendum. I'm afraid I have to go into the the politics of Germany. Germany was a federal state. It had the Reichstag, which ran Germany as a whole, but it also had state governments. Now, the problem about that was that the one state, or province, or whatever you call it, Prussia, was actually a majority of Germany. So you had a Prussian government, which was solidly social democratic all the way through. And then there was a referendum against it in 1931. And the Communist Party had to have the position, what are you going to do? Are you going to vote for the hated social democrats? Or are you going to vote against them and, in effect, vote for the Nazis? And in the end, they were told, the German Communist Party was told by Stalin, that they voted with the Nazis against the Social Democrats. So you can imagine, if you're some left social democratic worker, pissed off with the way your leadership is behaving, but nevertheless looking towards the Communist Party and thinking, oh my God, no. You know, you're just going to stick with your social democratic leadership. The social democratic leadership were pathetic. Obviously, as Trotskyists, we spend most of our time lambasting the Communist Party because they had the levers of change in their hands. But don't forget how pathetic the Social Democrats were. They appealed all the time to the state, the impartial state. And the state wasn't impartial. The state was actually, sections of the state were subsidising Nazis. And certainly, if a Nazi got into a court and was being accused of killing a worker, they would get off with a few months, whereas if it was one of our lot, you know, you'd be down for the rest of your life. And so you got this position where they were appealing to the state. And there were votes for the president and a bloke called Hindenburg, who was a monarchist, who wore his sort of full monarchist uniform. He became the president of the Republic, which you might think is, you know, what a bloody cheek. The man's a complete monarchist. But Hitler wasn't sure whether to run against him. The Social Democrats did their usual thing. Well, this bloke's a monarchist, but he's the lesser evil compared with Hitler. So they voted for Hindenburg, which is pretty dreadful position. You know, you would have thought a Labour movement candidate should run. And then Thielmann stood as the leader of the Communist Party. And Hindenburg won, Hitler came second, and Thielmann came third with nearly 5 million votes for the Communist Party. And you were getting this incredibly super optimistic. It was even better than the Taffites in the 80s about, you know, we're there now. We're on the verge of socialism. Yes, we're on the verge of power. The Communist Party is marching steadfastly towards power. And all the real workers could see that the Nazis were going to get there first. And the Nazis actually lost 2 million votes at the end of 32, but by then it was too late, because I'm sure the Italian comrades can tell us what happened in Italy, but there's this myth as well that there was some sort of fascist revolution. But actually what happened in January 33 was that in effect the ruling class decided they'd give Hitler a go. There was this continual deadlock in the Reichstag. The ruling class, in the form of Hindenburg, invited Adolf Hitler to form a government. You know, that was what we did this stuff in on the website on the 30th of January. Invited him to form a government as the leader of the right wing bloc. Hitler came in, and then he. We know what happened. Within 3 months, he'd made the Communist Party illegal, Social Democrats illegal, all three independent trade unions were made illegal. And he was able to use the forces of the state as well as his own bunch of thugs. You know, he had lots of groups of thugs, actually, you know, the SA, the SS, and all this. And right to the last minute, the workers were waiting for the signal. And despite all this verbal leftism from the Communist Party, never a signal came. They did not fight. They went down, as Adolf Hitler said, without so much as breaking a pane of glass. The German Social Democrats had huge bodies of armed men. They had things called the Reichsbanner. There were various sort of quasi-military outfits that were under the control of the German social democracy. They still controlled the Prussian state government, you know, with all the police and army there. They were under the control of the Social Democrats. They didn't use them. It's almost beyond belief. There's a book that was published as a left book a long time ago. I'm sure it's been out of print for a long time. It's called The Darker the Night, the Brighter the Stars. And it's by a German communist called Schlotterbeck. And this bloke was being sent out in January and February while the Nazi gangs were going around in razors just killing anyone. They were sending them out to leaflet factories in the morning. They were actually sending them out as sacrificial lambs. He was involved in that, and of course most of the people that went out there were just sitting ducks, weren't they, standing outside a factory giving out leaflets where the fascist gang turns up. And that went on for several months. And then you got a meeting of the Communist International. I mean, it's almost beggar's belief. But you go into this meeting, and there'd be all these empty chairs. You know, the largest section of the Communist International outside the Soviet Union. And they're not there. And nobody mentioned the fact that the working class had suffered the most serious defeat they'd ever suffered. And not only that, they actually turned round and then adopted a completely opposite programme from the one that they've been pushing for the last 5 years. Because Stalin had panicked again, he'd now, because of his own stupidity, actually got Hitler on his doorstep, so he was desperate to make a pact with Anglo-French imperialism. So he therefore told the communist parties in France, in Spain, and even the small communist party in Britain to form popular fronts with progressive capitalists. And really, they were just being used as pawns in Soviet diplomacy. But the conclusion that Trotsky drew was that the communist parties were rotten. Not only had they made a fundamental mistake, but they hadn't even noticed, apparently, that they'd made a mistake. And he started to write pamphlets like "It's Necessary to Build the Party and the International Anew." He realised that now, under the leadership of the Communist International, you would never get a workers' revolution anywhere else. Socialism in one country had led to socialism in no other country. Therefore, you needed a political revolution in Russia, and you needed to build a new international. And he didn't mention, for instance, the movement of the Austrian working class, but there was an Austrian fascist coup in February 1934. There was virtually no communist party in Austria, and the Austrian workers at least fought. You know, they did get guns out, and had, you know, they were heavily outnumbered. The other side had machine guns. The good guys just had rifles, hunting rifles and stuff like that. But they fought because they could see it was coming their way. They had no alternative but to fight. And it was things like that that caused the crisis in the French Socialist Party in the same year that caused Trotsky to think, well, the communist parties have been dead actually for quite a long while. To be honest, that was... you wouldn't have wanted to join the Communist Party in 1932. It was a party of unemployed. You know, they were just... the political level was down here. All they were doing was action all the time, so-called action. But, I mean, when it came to actually fighting fascism, when it came, no action. And nobody apparently was in a position to get up and say, hey, shouldn't we be doing something about this? There doesn't seem to be any framework that you could actually articulate or influence policy in any way whatsoever. So that was it. There was what you saw then was a change in Trotsky's position based on what he saw as the change in reality, as the further degeneration of Russian Stalinism and with it of the Communist International. Just very briefly on the evolution of fascism. Fascism was a mass movement, but of course they have these deluded plebeian supporters who think that it is a revolution and that in some mysterious way they're going to be in charge. Hitler was very clear to slap down people, more so than Mussolini, and in fact in a very spectacular way, the Sturmabteilung, the SAs, the brown shirts, which was the classic lumpen gangs that were used by the fascists, were just wiped out in 1934 in the Night of the Long Knives. They just killed them all and more or less turned the country over to big business. So, you know, it starts as a mass movement. It ends up, in effect, as just a grim dictatorship that obviously, in the case of Germany, took Germany to absolute catastrophe. But we got these rather sentimental idea about these coup plotters in 1944. I mean, to be honest, if you were the German bourgeoisie in 1934, you'd probably think Hitler was quite a good idea. By 1944, you'd probably think he was quite a poor idea. But the trouble is that you don't have any levers of control over him. So you got these people like Rommel and that, who attempted to have a coup against Hitler, and they were just they were just destroyed, but so was Germany in the process. Now, I'm going to keep it purely as the story. So if we want to talk about what happened other places, what's likely to happen here in the future, that's up to you. Well, I hope you will, you know, but that's up to you.